Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In the book, The World Without Us, today's guest, Alan Weissman, imagined what would happen if we all vanished from the planet. The goal was to show that despite the damage we've wreaked, nature has remarkable resilience and healing powers. His main question was, how can we continue to have a world with us? Well, a world in which a million more of us are born every 4.5 days, a million new people every 4.5 days. If we continue at this rate, in 40 years, we'll be sharing the planet with over 9 billion people. In his latest book, Alan Weissman looks at population growth and argues that if we don't curb our growth, we may lead ourselves down the path of extinction. He traveled to 21 countries to ask what he and others say are some of the most important questions of our time. How many humans can the planet hold without capsizing? How robust must the Earth's ecosystems be to ensure our continued existence? And how might we arrive at a stable, optimum population and design an economy to have genuine prosperity without endless growth? Alan Weissman is an award-winning journalist. His reports have appeared in Harper's, The New York Times Magazine, The Atlantic, and on NPR. And he joins us from CBC Studios in Canada. Hi, Alan. Welcome back to the show.
Rose, it's great to be back with you. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. It's great to have you back. I can't believe it's been a little while since we had you on, but I still remember when you came on into the studio to talk about the book, The World Without Us, because I loved the idea of just thinking about what happens when humans disappear. And the book has been translated into several languages. What did you really learn from that book that led you to explore these new questions?
Well, when I was doing The World Without Us, My motivation for that was to try to find a way to write an environmental book that would be read by a lot more people than the usual suspects, the one who already know what the world's environmental issues are. I had been to so many of them over the planet for various publications, you know, from the ozone hole to the Chernobyl disaster to many rainforests coming down. And finally, you know, I hit upon this novel way to kind of disarm the fear factor of, oh, my God, are we all going to die? You know, why am I reading this depressing thing? Which was, you know, just kill everybody off in the beginning. They didn't have to worry about that anymore. But lurking behind that was, as you mentioned in your intro, my desire to continue to have a world with us. I like my species. You know, I'm married to a Homo sapiens. Most of my friends are Homo sapiens. And we do some beautiful creative things. And I don't want to see us disappear. But in the epilogue of that book, where I wanted to get around to this question of, okay, how could we add ourselves back to this picture of a newly rejuvenated, restored Earth when it's relieved of all the pressures that we heap on it daily? I ran into this disturbing fact that, you know, as you mentioned, every 4 to 4.5 days, there's a million more people on the planet. Just didn't seem very sustainable. So at the end of that book, I did really unexpectedly another thought experiment. It was unexpected even to me. I hadn't thought about population, but I got a demographics institute in Vienna, which is one of the world's most distinguished, to run the numbers for me on what would happen to the world population if, setting aside all social concerns, we all participated in the Chinese experiment, you know, just one child per family. And it turns out that by the end of this century, we'd be back to that number you stated before, 1.6 billion at the beginning of the 20th century, when our numbers doubled and then doubled again, you know, in just 100 years for reasons that we can talk about. Now, 1.6 billion sounds like a much more sustainable population. There's breathing room for us. There's breathing room for other species. And unfortunately, we're starting to push off the edge of the planet. But the question I left hanging is, you know, well, is this something that we really need to be thinking about? And if so, is it possible? Is it practical? You know, the Chinese one-child policy is not palatable to hardly anybody on this planet, including the most Chinese. Anyhow, the question became so interesting to so many people. I believe we discussed it a bit when I was on your air the last time, that finally I decided that I should – as a journalist, investigate this thing as objectively as possible, because it's such a loaded question, and the result is this book, Countdown.
And what's interesting is we've done a few shows over the years about population growth, population control, but this is still something that environmentalists, or at least most of the environmentalists we've had on the show, don't really spend much time talking about. Why do you think that is?
Well, still, it's a loaded question. You know, it makes us all uncomfortable. Because, like any other organism, we are designed to make more copies of ourselves. In fact, we're designed to make extra copies of ourselves because up until the end of the 18th century, when Edward Jenner developed our first vaccine, that one was for smallpox, and it was soon followed by many other vaccines and many other advances in medical technology, such as pasteurization of milk, the development of antiseptics. You know, until then, more of our children died than survived into adulthood to have more children themselves. So our population barely grew until the beginning of the 19th century. And then through those medical advances, and then followed in the 20th century by a couple of advances in food technology that we'll talk about, our population utterly exploded. Now, all of us are born as part of that population explosion, and we look around, the world that's so familiar to us seems like this must be the normal world, but it is not the normal world. Suddenly, in the last 200 years, our population curve shot straight up from what before was a very, very, very gradual, gradually rising line. We are now entering a territory where we are overwhelming the natural world that supports our presence. And this is probably not going to be able to continue, whether we like it or not. But it's uncomfortable because so many religions and so many political systems have always started with a mandate to be fruitful and multiply because they wanted to be the most powerful ones around. So it is uncomfortable for many environmentalists because it kind of detracts from whatever their main topic is, be it global warming or biodiversity. There's always this fear that it's going to kind of sidetrack the issue into something that is so loaded.
Now, you traveled to 21 countries, and you have so many amazing stories to share. To ask people what you believe, and a lot of the people that you interviewed believe, are some of the most important questions of our time. And the first one is, how many humans can the planet hold without capsizing? How did you come up with that question, and why do you think that's one of the most important questions we should be asking right now?
Well, because it's looking like, you know, capsizing is kind of a metaphorical term. Another way of thinking of it is, you know, like we're this imagine a ball that's sewn together, as, you know, the old pigskin balls were, and we're starting to burst at its seams as more and more and more gets pumped inside of that ball. We can see it right now and what's going on in our atmosphere as we've become addicted to concentrated energy, which, by the way, has been one of the drivers for our population expansion, because without concentrated energy, we would not have artificial fertilizer, without which there would be 40% fewer of us. It's completely changed the way that nature produces plant life. As we use this energy, we're pumping carbon dioxide into our atmosphere, which, I mean, you can think of it as like just putting more insulation into this blanket of atmosphere that we have that holds in the sun's heat. And so it gets warmer and warmer, and then the seas get warmer as they absorb that heat, and they expand and they begin to rise, and they absorb this carbon, which turns them more towards the acidic side of the pH scale. You know, these are monumental changes such as we have never seen in human history. The last time there was this much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere was 3 million years ago, and that's before Homo sapiens. And the seas were 60 to 100 feet higher. right now we're using 40% of the land's surface just to feed ourselves, either grazing or cultivating. And there are a lot of other species on this planet that also was using that land before we became so powerful.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because we've had a couple conversations in the last few months about food, for example. Winona Howder with Food and Water Watch is out with a book called Foodopoly. And we talked about the fact that the problem is the systems. And if you were able to really change food policy and, you know, put people before profits, we could actually feed everyone on the planet. And so a lot of people argue that the problem is the way that the laws are written and the way that systems work. We could actually do it right. We're just not. We're choosing not to. What do you think about that argument?
Well, I agree with it only in part. I agree that our food systems are deplorable in that most of the food raised on this planet is not really for sustenance. It's for profit. It's a commodity. And that food is not going to be distributed equitably because it only goes to the highest bidders. Where I disagree is this. I mean, you know, I went to the Vatican for this book, and one of the reasons was a 2009 encyclical by Pope Benedict XVI, who essentially said the same thing. If we distributed our food more equitably, there's enough for everybody on this planet. And one of the questions I had was, now when the Pope is talking about food enough for everybody, is he just talking about Homo sapiens, or is he talking about other species? And that question gave everybody pause in the Vatican, and they admitted that, you know, biodiversity was not really part of their projection. And I think that it's something really essential that we have to consider, that we're not the only species on this planet. It's not just because, you know, we have an ethical obligation to our companions on this planet to provide enough food for them. We need them. Our natural systems are deeply dependent on our pollinators, our seed spreaders, our insect devourers, and there are numerous other ways. They help naturally fertilize. There are numerous contributions that other species make to this planet. And if we're taking up too much of the land for ourselves for food production, we are depriving them, and there's a direct correlation between that and the number of species that we are forcing off the planet. Also, in order to create the food that we are creating, we're force-feeding the land with chemistry in two ways. One of them I already mentioned. Artificial nitrogen fertilizer simply blew the lid off of what nature could do. 40% of us, again, would not be here without it. But the crops that we then develop to take best advantage of artificial nitrogen fertilizer to produce the greatest number of grains per stalk, and this was, of course, developed during the Green Revolution of the 1960s, these plants were bred in laboratory conditions, and they need a lot of protection because they didn't evolve over millennia to ward off natural predators. And as a result, we use pesticides and we use herbicides so other plants don't compete in the soil for the nutrients that we're adding. And all of these are coming back to bite us in very, very painful ways. I just read a report this morning in the Globe and Mail here in Canada how Argentina, which is now, you know, plowing up the pampas to grow GMO soybeans and has some of the highest pesticide use anywhere on Earth right now, suddenly there are significant cancer clusters bursting out through all of rural Argentina. We already know, you know, in your state of California, we know very well that there's a correlation. So I'm not so sure that we can just say that we can distribute food equitably and there'll be no problem. We have serious problems here. And trying to accommodate all the people on Earth is really, it's a generous gesture, but it's not really contextual. It's a little misguided.
We're speaking with Alan Weissman, award-winning journalist who's out with a new book called Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. He points out that every 4.5 days, 1 million people are born. And I wanted to put this in context. So according to the website Wholesome Words, we've got 15,000 births every hour, and about 6,300 people die every hour. So 15,000 people are born every hour over the course of the show, and about 6,300 people will die over the course of this show. So how do you put these numbers into context? And what are your thoughts? I'm just going to give the number out quickly, Alan, and then I'll ask you that question. I just want to find out what listeners think about this issue about population growth and population control. This isn't something we spend much time talking about. Why is that? And do you think that the question Alan asked when he traveled to 21 countries, how many people can the Earth sustain? And how might we arrive at a stable population and design an economy to have prosperity without endless growth? Are these the right questions to be asking? And what is a stable population? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts on the other questions? Are the systems the problem, or is it just the fact that if we continue down this road, we're going to have to share the planet with over 9 billion people? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So, Alan, how should we put this in perspective? 15,000 births every hour, 6,300 deaths every hour.
Well, I'm not familiar with that website. The UN's Population Division, and I spoke to a woman who was the head of it for many years, and they're pretty much the clearinghouse for all data. And, you know, they say that there are roughly about 120 million births every year and about 40 million die. The total net gain per year is 80 million. And if you divide that by 365 and then divide by 4, that's how you come up with my figure that nobody contests, that, you know, we have a million more every 4 to 4.5 days. It's simply too many people. You know, this Earth existed in kind of balance for a long time when we were far fewer. And I hear, you know, all these objections. You know, one of them that I heard, I was on a radio program the other day, was someone who's concerned that the population is dropping in developed nations because women aren't having enough babies. And he said, you know, where are the innovators going to come from in the future? I always hear the question, you know, like, well, the next baby could be the next Mozart. So, you know, my reply to that is, you know, when Mozart was born, there were fewer than 500 million people on the planet. We have a rich human history of innovation and creativity long before the last 200 years when suddenly we spiked up to a huge population, and so much of the innovation that we have been dealing with in the last 200 years is simply how to accommodate so many more of us. That's what the Green Revolution was about, you know, to try to feed suddenly burgeoning masses. And when people point to the Green Revolution as having refuted the claims of Malthus or Paul and Ann Ehrlich, who wrote The Population Bomb, you know, they are conveniently ignoring the fact that when Norman Borlaug, the founder of the Green Revolution, won the Nobel Peace Prize, his acceptance speech was devoted to the topic that basically we'd bought the world a generation or so of time, that unless enhanced food production and population management went hand in hand, all was going to be lost. And until Borlaug died a few years ago, he was on the board of population groups. He said that it was absolutely essential because he understood the paradox of food. The more people that you feed, the more people survive to beget more people. So food production actually increases population. Today, when you go to the two countries where where the Green Revolution was tried out first, they were on the verge of famine, India and Pakistan. Well, India is about to surpass China as the most populous country on Earth. And Pakistan, and I went to both places for countdown, Pakistan's got nearly 190 million. This is in a country the size of Texas, which only has 26 million. By the middle of this century, it's going to far outstrip today's United States. It'll have nearly 400 million at present growth rates. It'll still be the size of Texas. Its economy can't possibly keep up with everybody who needs a job. So you've got all these frustrated, angry young men who become, you know, what we in the United States term as terrorists. And it's a nuclear power. Dwight D. Eisenhower, back in the 1950s, pointed out that population growth was the greatest international global security threat in the post-war era. And he appointed one of his World War II generals to study it, and that general spent the rest of his life devoted to population management because this is something that is really overwhelming us, and yet it looks so normal to us we don't really quite notice it.
Well, clearly listeners want to talk about this because we have full lines, so let's take a few calls before we go to break. Let's hear from Gail in Menlo Park. Hi, Gail. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. Yes, I just wanted to ask our guest and sort of point out the importance of education and medical care in reducing population growth. Every place where women have become educated and where medical care was available, the population has plummeted. Mm-hmm. A notable example of this is in Quebec. And then the other thing is when you talk about food, you have to consider the role of corruption in advertising in promoting consumption of meat and milk products, which are overconsumed in wealthy countries. People in many parts of the world produce a much lower impact on the planet than people do in developed countries. And a good part of this is due to advertising and corruption in the food production and the political system producing, pushing the production of the wrong kinds of food.
Well, thank you for calling, Gail. You brought up a number of points. Alan, do you want to take the first one about education and, birth control, really?
Well, the caller's quite right. The best contraceptive of all is female education. Mm-hmm. I have a fascinating example in this book. The last country that I traveled to was Iran. In 1979, after the Islamic Revolution, Iran was immediately attacked by Saddam Hussein. He figured that this disorganized country that had just gotten rid of centuries of dynastic rule would be unable to defend an oil-rich province on its border. Iran responded by asking every fertile female to get pregnant to help build a 20 million man army to fend off the invaders. And for the next 8 years, they held Iraq to a stalemate. But following that, they realized that they had a tremendous problem. Just like Pakistan, you know, they were going to have a huge generation that they probably wouldn't be able to employ. So they instituted a family planning program. The Chinese one-child policy had been in effect for 10 years, and they knew that that wasn't right for their population. So they instituted a voluntary program. And it involved, first of all, a fatwa saying that there's nothing in the Quran that says if wisdom dictates you've got the number of children that you want, that you can't use anything from condoms up to vasectomy or tubal ligation. Second, they made that available all over the country. Third, the only compulsory thing was premarital classes, and among other things in those classes, you learn how much it costs to raise and feed and educate a child. Mm. And fourth, they encouraged women to stay in school because the longer a woman
Alan,
studies...
I hate to cut you off, but we're going to just take a quick break. We're speaking with Alan Weissman, author of Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can participate in this conversation anytime by sending an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or if you're listening to our morning broadcast, you can participate by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Your call is better when you become involved.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk about the challenges abortion providers face. We'll have a conversation about the new documentary that's in theaters now, After Tiller. It documents the struggles abortion care providers have faced since 2009 when Dr. George Tiller was murdered in his Wichita, Kansas church. His clinic, which provides third trimester abortions, reopened its doors this year. That procedure is now performed by only four doctors in the country, and they face regular death threats. So we'll talk about why they do this work and what is happening across the country. And then on Friday, it's our media roundtable. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line. feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are speaking with journalist Alan Weissman about his latest book, his newest book, Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. He's also author of The World Without Us, which looks at what would happen if we all just vanished from the planet one day. Well, his new book takes a look at the fact that we're here and there are more of us, a million more of us every 4.5 days. He traveled to 21 countries to ask what he and others say are some of the most important questions of our time. How many humans can the planet hold without capsizing? So what are your thoughts on this? Do you think this is the right question we need to be asking? And when you think about this, that 4.5 days, we've got a million new people, how do you put that into perspective? And what are your thoughts on population growth and population control? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. So before the break, Alan, you were talking about this voluntary program in Iran that made every kind of contraception free to everyone and encouraged women to study.
Yeah. And, you know, at the time that it was implemented, maybe only a third of Iranian women were literate. Well, literacy programs and schooling were part of the package. But when a woman is studying, she tends to defer her childbearing until her studies are through. And then once they're done, she's got something interesting and useful to do with her life, economically helpful. She probably wants to be a mother, but you can't exercise a profession if you've got 7 kids to take care of. So on the average around the world, you get a woman through high school and she's probably going to have 2 kids or fewer. Mm. In Iran, the population, the fertility rate came down to replacement rate, that is 2 people on the average producing 2 children to replace themselves, a year faster than China. And today, 60% of the university students in Iran are female. This stuff works in country after country. Everywhere I went, poor countries, rich country, you educate a woman, she knows, and you make contraceptives available to her, and she knows what she wants to do.
What did you find in your travels that we don't know about that maybe excited you about access to birth control?
Well, again, the Iranian one seems to just blow everybody's mind in the United States. I found that there were many different ways to approach this. Another good poster example for education is Italy, which is a country that is, you know, it hosts the Vatican, and yet it has one of the lowest fertility rates on the planet because Italian women are so well educated. It has one of the highest per capita percentages of women with graduate degrees anywhere. Thailand is a country, it's a Buddhist country that has a sex industry as one of the pillars of its economy. And yet it came down to replacement rate. In fact, it's below replacement rate now simply because of a very ingenious publicity campaign that was all based on humor. And the humor was based on the condom, which is kind of it's a silly looking thing. As one economist who started to bring condoms with him. He was working in development in Thailand. He started going around the country trying to start programs, but every town that he went to was just teeming with children. He realized there was no way that their economy could keep up with the population. So, holding condoms up all the time and trying to talk about family planning was drawing a blank until one day, sort of unconsciously, he unwrapped the foil package and was holding this long, limp thing, and everybody started to titter. And then he realized he had their attention. So right in front of a group of 2,000 school teachers, he blew it up. And everybody just burst into laughter. Yeah. And suddenly he's passing out condoms. And there's a condom blowing up contest going on. And then it went nationwide. And just through continually playing on this joke, people started to get the idea. Hmm. You know, I went to all these countries because I wanted to see, was there something in the cultures or in the histories of all the world's great religions or political systems that might possibly embrace the idea of, as you know, our Bible says, you know, in Ecclesiastes, of refraining from embracing so much in times of need. And it turns out there are plenty of things. Judeo-Christian history, you know, we started out as polygamists for the same reason the Mormons did a little later on, because it's a strategy to have a lot of children and build a mighty nation. But then one of Jacob's 13 children, Joseph, realized that we're entering a time of scarcity. He was probably our first ecologist, in a sense. He's very observant. So he has only one wife and just two children, and he counsels the Israelites and the Pharaoh of Egypt that now is the time to do the same in order to save ourselves. Well, I'm wondering if we're not looking at the same kind of thing.
We're speaking with Alan Weissman, author of the new book, Countdown, and we've got full lines. We'll have a line open in just a few minutes at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Let's hear next from Ruthann in El Cerrito. Good morning, Ruthann.
Good morning. I wanted to know if your guest had heard or had read Paul Ehrlich's The Population Bomb, which came out a while ago, boy, when I was an adolescent. And I think that was asserting that it sounds kind of Malthusian, that the increased population with finite resources was going to doom us unless we controlled the population. And then in following that, there had been a lot of discussion amongst progressives about the problem was not so much population that was an affront to, you know, women and childbearing, but that the problem was use of resources and, you know, there's plenty of food to feed the planet. It's just the distribution and how it's decided who gets the food.
Well, Paul Ehrlich is, and his wife Anne, are characters in my book. You know, I'm sort of a storyteller. There's no way to deliver difficult material and get readers to read it unless you can couch it around a human story. And it's important to understand that when the population bomb came out in 1968, it was really one of the great stimulators of the environmental movement in the United States, in fact, in the world, because it sold millions worldwide. Back then, the population was less than half of what we have today. And it became attacked very quickly for the same reason that the caller just inadvertently uttered. It was characterized as Malthusian. There was a huge propaganda machine that tried to say that Malthus was, and the Ehrlichs were proved wrong, again because of the Green Revolution, as I described earlier in this conversation. And yet no one has ever proved them wrong. And the founder of the Green Revolution was the one who was one of their most stalwart backers. Population can grow exponentially, while food production only grows arithmetically. It always overtakes it. And even though our population growth has declined, it's still growing. It's just not growing as fast as it was before. But even so, the UN Population Division has just revised its former predictions. They thought for a while that everything was going to level off by about at 9.2 billion by the middle of this century, because more people are urbanized and you don't need to have a lot of kids like you do on the farm to be farmhands. But now it looks like we're headed beyond 9.6 by the middle of the century, and we're going to 11 billion at the end of the century. Plus, that it depends on current levels of contraception that are available out there. And those lines are pretty fragile because they really depend on the United States. Hmm. We're the biggest donor. If there's only a half a child more per woman in the world, if those supply lines are cut. And frankly, in the last presidential election, the opponents of President Obama vowed to cut them. We'd be headed towards a 16 billion by the end of the century. Whereas if we make them universally available, contraceptives, we'd be back to 6 billion by the middle of the century. By the end of the century, we'd be headed more towards sustainable territory. As for the question about equitable distribution of food, I've already covered that one, so I don't think we have to talk about it again. The important thing, though, to understand is that our food production is really overwhelming our soil. It's overwhelming our water. The Green Revolution in India, which saved them all from famine. I go to India. I go to the Punjab where the Green Revolution, you know, that's where it took place. That's the breadbasket there. And when it started, the wells were 50 feet deep. And then they went to 500 and they went to 1,000 feet deep. And I spoke to, for a day, I just interviewed widows of farmers, Green Revolution farmers who've committed suicide because of not being able to afford to keep drilling their wells. This is a staggering figure. Since 1995, 270,000 Green Revolution farmers have committed suicide, and the symbolic method of choice is by drinking pesticide.
Wow.
We can't keep doing this.
Well, thank you for calling again, Ruthann. Let's go next to Kevin in Felton. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. When your guest first began his address, he glanced on a really interesting part of this problem, which is discussing the issue of population growth without getting into a political trap. And I've watched for years. I do conservation work, and I've been around for a long time. And I noticed as the conservation advocates, there's a few national organizations that work on the issue, they started to lose support, and other organizations that had been involved in the question withdrew from it. And this is mainly because there were assertions being made that those advocating for population control were somehow selecting, say, an ethnic group or a race that they preferred and trying to suppress the growth of other ethnic groups. And we really have to get past this confusion if we're going to be able to discuss this question, this problem, on a national level, because that is a game stopper. People will just clam up if they're, playing the race card in regard to controlling global population. Just shuts down advocacy on the question. And I think it's really an interesting problem. You see it in Europe with the rise of right-wing political parties, like in France, Le Pen, and so on. But regardless of the fact that those people exist, the problem with overpopulation is much larger and goes beyond any question about who is advocating for it and why, and we have to sort this out to get anywhere. And that's the primary comment I wanted to make. Thank you.
Well, thank you for that comment. It's an important one. Look, the history of population management, and I use that term because population control itself is such a loaded term. It gives the sense that, you know, some government is going to mandate control. And if one message is very clear in my book, Countdown, that you don't need governments telling you what to do. You need people being given the opportunity to make that decision for themselves. The issue was, you know, complicated by the eugenics movement, which was taught in all of our universities in the United States and Europe, you know, from Harvard on down, suggesting that only the right kind of people should be procreating. And that meant anybody from mental defectives, as they called them, or invalids, as they called them, or even, as was very suggested, oftentimes suggested, the wrong color. Fortunately, as things cleared up over the years, for example, Martin Luther King was a very, very important supporter of the idea of population management and a supporter of Planned Parenthood. This definitely environmental groups got besmirched by this problem. There's another aspect to it that the caller didn't mention, and that's migration. The Sierra Club got in a lot of trouble of trying to decide whether immigration should be considered an environmental issue. And, you know, Edward Abbey was an old friend of mine, and we used to argue about this one. He liked the idea of a fence at the Mexican border to try to preserve the ecosystems that he so much loved in the United States. He felt that they would be overwhelmed. And my argument was always that, look, we're talking biology here. Organisms will move towards resources, and a fence ultimately is not going to be able to stop them. To me, cultural enrichment is the reason why the United States became so much the wonderful country that it sometimes can be. You know, my father was an immigrant to the United States, and you scratch any of us except for Native Americans, and we're all children of immigrants. So, you know, in this book, I go to Western Europe. In my chapter in England begins with one of these ultra-right-wing politicians. His great-great-great-grandfather was literally the founder of the Industrial Revolution, the guy who invented cast iron and the blast furnace. And he's just perplexed that his country is now filled with all these foreigners who are out-competing his kind for jobs. Well, these are social concerns that we have to take into account. But wherever people are born on this planet, either they're going to become a human tragedy because there's not enough food to support them, or that are going to become immigrants. On the one hand, they are going to enrich us culturally, but they're also going to increase the pressures. But ultimately, we all live in one country. It's called Earth, and we're all contributing to one carbon dioxide, to one atmosphere.
We have an email from Catherine who says, a conundrum I grapple with all the time is how population is going to be reduced. Will nature do it for us with a global pandemic for which we have no prevention or cure? Mass starvation? Will we do it ourselves? And then she brings up old eugenic ideas of getting rid of so-called undesirables, the mentally ill, disabled, or what? She says, no one wants to or is willing to discuss this. It makes me uncomfortable, and I haven't seen a way through it yet. I only know that whatever the rest of us decide to do, if we actually do something, it must be a mass movement. Women's education is a good first step, but it must be done en masse, every woman in every community in the world. But how is that going to happen when privateers are increasingly in control of the resources needed to provide such educational facilities?
Well, you know, these are good questions. But again, I don't believe that it needs a government program other than support from us to convince our Congress, to convince our president to continue to provide. It's one of the great things that the United States does through USAID to continue to provide contraception throughout the world. We're by far the world's biggest donor of this, and we need to keep doing it. Education should be fostered everywhere. You know, I mentioned the example of Pakistan, you know, as being this just basket case country now. It's really, really tragic what's going on there. And yet one of the most hopeful stories I have in this book is in Pakistan. Five Pakistani businessmen were out to dinner one night in Karachi, and they were just whining about how their country was going to hell and how the schools were so bad. Teachers only showed up once a month to collect their paycheck. And they decided there and then to start their own school system in the poorest parts of the country. It's a private school system, but it costs pennies to go there. They intentionally made it co-educational. And I went to some of these schools. Girls and boys are being educated next to each other so the boys can learn to respect girls. When they get into secondary school, every child picks a profession that they think they might like to enter, and they're assigned a mentor. And the girls are paired up then usually with women doctors or nurses or flight attendants or school teachers. And they get the message without the word family planning being uttered that these women only have a couple of kids so they can keep doing their job. And that's how it spreads. And I asked one of the founders, I said, well, you know, the Taliban's blowing up schools for educating women in your country. And they said, we just tell the Taliban, go ahead, blow up one of our schools. We promise for everyone you blow up, we're gonna build five more. They've got over 415 schools now in Pakistan, and it's growing like crazy. So we can do this. We human beings can do this.
You know, I have to say, when I was reading your book and when you write about contraception in other countries and education in other countries, I couldn't help but think, wow, wouldn't that be great to have in this country? Because who would have thought that in the year 2013, we would be fighting for birth control, right? And the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention came out with their first publication ever on the importance of emergency contraception in the United States to basically prove and say that, yes, contraception must be available to women in the United States. So what are your thoughts on that? I mean, did you ever think that we would be fighting for birth control in the year 2013 in this country?
Well, you know, we have a very polarized nation right now. But it's important for us to understand that it's in really more polarized in image than in reality, because the extremes scream the loudest and they unfortunately get a lot of attention. You know, the profession of journalism sometimes doesn't discriminate a lot when somebody's being kind of sensationalistic, because it makes for good copy. You know, we've just seen how our government closed down because a few yahoos decided to take it hostage, and it turns out that they badly miscalculated. The majority of Americans didn't want that.
But we do have...
The same thing goes for...
A lot of clinics in Texas, for example, that are shutting down because of these laws and these fights.
Well, Texas is a real problem because the strategy, you know, which was one of the architects of which was Karl Rove, was to gerrymander all of its congressional districts to constantly have a very conservative majority in charge of those laws. And they're going to get away with that until redistricting comes around again. But, you know, but Texas doesn't have to be the tail that wags the dog of this country. And there's also, you know, a woman who just stood up, you know, for many, many hours on her feet to argue for sanity, who's running for governor and getting a lot of attention in Texas. So I don't think that fight is over yet. You know, there was a program. Let me backtrack 1 second. I explain in my book how Mexico came down to near replacement rate now through a wonderful family planning program that used both it provided in the clinics not just birth control pills but vaccinations, so women knew that their living children wouldn't die on them, but also it used the telenovela, the soap operas, to convey a message that small families look like they're getting along a lot better than really big families, and that the macho husband who insists that his wife produce more babies ultimately by the 19th episode suddenly comes around and realizes that happiness is in making his wife happy. And you could just track the drop of fertility rate in Mexico with the success of those soap operas. There's a version of it that is now running in East Los Angeles right now. It's called Istla, and it does basically the same thing. It shows teenage girls dealing with this issue of teenage pregnancy and how to control it, and the message, I think, is going to be just as effective. There are soap operas now in languages all throughout the world, and this is very, very helpful.
And what about, I mean, you touch on this also, but what about consumption and conservation? Because if you look at who uses what, we're guilty. I mean, the United States, Americans use more when you look at per capita use of, name it, forest production, fish, grains, fresh water, energy, metals. Fossil fuel consumption is double that of the average resident of Great Britain, two-thirds or 2.5 times that of the average Japanese. We're 5% of the population, but we create half of the waste. What about those issues?
Look, if anybody thinks that I'm suggesting in this book that because the main burst of population in the world is in poor countries like Africa and South Asia, that I'm suggesting we just sort of squelch their population growth. No, you've got to multiply population by consumption. And in that case, the United States is the most overpopulated country on the planet. We have to manage our population everywhere. But the problem with consumption, look, we should consume less and we should conserve more. We should do everything in our power to do those things. But frankly, I haven't found a condom for consumption, you know, to quote Paul Ehrlich. There just doesn't seem to be one. You and I are talking to each other through electricity, and, you know, those electrons are propelling carbon dioxide molecules up into the air. And, you know, every day we're all part of the problem. Even the poorest people on Earth, as more and more of them are living in cities now, it's amazing. You go into the poorest slums, and I went to Manila and Pakistan and India, and they get cell phones. And the electricity may be pirated, but they're plugging in their chargers at night. So this is something that we really all have to bring down. And fortunately, though, this is something that we have the technology for. It's not like zero emission energy. Now, we know how to do this, and it's really cheap.
And Alan, we have about 20 seconds left. Based on all the travels that you did, the conversations you had, where do you see this going? What changes would you like to see?
Look, for less money annually than the United States was spending every month in Iraq and Afghanistan, a little over $8 billion, which isn't much, we could provide contraception for everybody on Earth. Mm. That's where I know we have to be going. Mm.
Alan Weissman is author of Countdown, Our Last Best Hope for a Future on Earth. Alan, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Rose.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. What challenges do abortion providers face? On the next Your Call, we'll discuss the new film, After Tiller, which documents the struggles abortion care providers have faced since 2009, when Dr. George Tiller was murdered in his Wichita, Kansas church. His clinic, which provides third trimester abortions, reopened its doors this year. That procedure is now performed by only four doctors in the country. All former colleagues of Dr. Tiller, they risk their lives every day. So why do they do it? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.